I'm the dean there of an honors college, interdisciplinary honors college, and I teach intellectual history and humanities there. This is my second week at Holden this year, though I've been coming here pretty much every year since 1979, so I'm very much in love with the place, and have often been privileged to serve the village on the teaching staff. This year, I've decided that in view of the theme, No Longer Strangers, I would think a bit about what might be considered the opposite of alienation or estrangement, which would be love or friendship. And so last week, had some sessions on erotic love or romantic love. And this week, we'll have three sessions on friendship with an interesting film interlude yet this evening, the showing in this room of the film When Harry Met Sally, which will be shown at 8:30 and again at 10:30 if you like to have late night entertainment. This will, I think, be a film that you will find entertaining, and it turns out to be something of a minor classic, at least among my students, who can quote chapter and verse from When Harry Met Sally when it comes to friendships between men and women, which will be the subject of tomorrow's conversation at this same time. You don't have to have seen the movie to come tomorrow evening. We're not simply going to be talking, or even mainly going to be talking about the film, though of course we'll make some allusions to it tomorrow. So if you can't make the showings this evening, or if you took the long hike to Holden or are just recovering and going to hit the sack immediately after Vespers, don't let that deter you from coming if you're interested in the subject tomorrow, which will be friendships between men and women. Today, however, the title of the presentation is The Loves We Choose, Friendship, not, as it's posted up on the kiosk, The Lovers We Choose, The Loves We Choose, Friendship.
You're about ready to leave now.
Yeah. I was afraid that a lot of people might get up when they learn the actual title. But it's a title I put up there because it begins to do a little bit of the work I want to do together with you this evening, which is to get some sense of what friendship is, and to get some sense of what it is by contrast to other loves, in particular erotic or romantic love on the one hand and agape on the other. And I always give, for those of you who were here last week, a little assignment before I start to speak a bit about the subject and then open it up for conversation. I think that the assignment tonight is going to be to invite you to take a couple of minutes. I will time it. I have one of those fancy watches which I can actually press a little button and time reflections. You'll get it. Well, it's an anti-Holden thing, but I've been using it to run, and now that I've sprained my ankle, I have to use it to time something. Keep it kind of warmed up. Yeah. So I'm going to time you for 2 minutes. And what I want you to do is to conjure up in your mind three of your friends. And the more different the three of them are from one another, the better. And the purpose for doing this at the beginning of the class is that I think that in matters like this, when we talk about something that we all care about and share, if what I say and if what we talk about has no connection to actual experience, then there's something wrong with what's being said. And so I want you to have your inventory mentally up there of cross-checking some of the things we'll say in general about friendship with your own experience of friendship. And then later on, we'll ask people to perhaps volunteer some experiences and how they meet or fail to meet the kinds of general criteria that I'll have about friendship. So I'm going to press this button, and when I say go, you'll have 2 minutes to focus in on three of your best friends that you have made over the course of a lifetime. Go. Okay. Good. Just have those images and memories ready to hand and in the forefront of your mind as we talk now in somewhat more general terms about friendship for a bit. The whole subject of friendship in our own culture is not nearly as urgent and richly articulated and important as it has been at other times in Western history. For the ancient Greeks and Romans, for instance, friendship, at least among the educated classes, would have received much more diligent and sustained attention than, say, romantic love or erotic love. And indeed, human beings, again, of the educated classes at least, would have understood their own self-worth, understood their own identity as bound up much more closely with their friends and who their friends were than they would with what we tend to bind our identity and sense of self-worth up with today, which would be the kind of work we do. One of the things which has accounted for a kind of relative decline in the importance attached to and the thoughtfulness addressed to friendship has been the rise of the importance of work and vocation as a way of self-understanding and a way of people's identifying who they are, that is, by what they do rather than by whom they love. But for the ancients, friendship was understood as a virtue, and indeed for some, a kind of crowning virtue. Aristotle tells us in the Ethics that even if he or she had all other goods, no human being would choose to live unless he or she also had friends with whom they could share those goods and share that life. Other things that may have led to a relative decline in the importance of or our attention to friendship might be the incredible mobility of our society, people moving from place to place, not having secure and permanent roots in any one locale and constantly having relationships, therefore severed by that. There's also the ascendancy in our own culture, and this has been true for some centuries, of romantic love or erotic love, which we have attended to much more closely and rigorously since at least the 12th century than friendship, which went into a kind of eclipse by comparison to that around that time. And also within Christian communities, as we'll see as I develop a description of friendship, there are certain obvious tensions, not to say contradictions, between friendship and the Christian love or agape. And I want to talk a little bit now about what friendship is by virtue of contrasting it first with eros, which we talked about last week, and secondly with agape, which I'll spend a whole hour on at the very end of this week on Friday. So, I mentioned already, to get now into something of a discussion of the nature of friendship, that for the ancients, friendship was thought to be a virtue because it was grounded in choice and in character. We choose friends. It wasn't thought, and many of us still don't think today, that we always choose lovers. That is to say, we use expressions like love at first sight, or falling in love, or being overcome with passion. We don't speak, I don't think, about falling in friendship or having friendship at first sight. We may say, like Humphrey Bogart does at the end of Casablanca, in his character as Sam, who turns to Louis and says, "Louis, I think this is going to be the beginning of a long and beautiful friendship." So he has a kind of intimation of that, but that's based on a long association he's had with Louis, which has been dramatized during the course of the film. And one doesn't typically fall suddenly and madly into friendship and feel overcome by it. So one contrast between eros or romantic love and friendship would be that the one tends to be a virtue grounded in choice, friendship, and the other tends to be a passion, in which we are often, by which we are often overcome. And in that case, that kind of love is often grounded in desire, by comparison to choice. We talked indeed last week about eros being a kind of hunger or a kind of longing or a kind of desire. And friendship, by contrast, is often thought to be grounded in choice, not that it doesn't have warmth and affection connected to it as well. Another example of a contrast, or what's thought to be a contrast, between erotic love and friendship is that eros, or romance, tends to be rather exclusive and jealous. We often talk about, in matters of romantic love, two being a company and three being a crowd, whereas friendship oftentimes is by comparison more generous and more open, where two friends welcome into their midst three or four more friends, and the more the merrier. Not that people can't be jealous of other friendships, I know that that happens, but by comparison to eros, which at least according to one account that we read last week, actually thrives upon or grows more deep and more intense through jealousy, it's not at all clear that that kind of thing goes on as intensely with respect to friendship, which tends to be, by comparison to eros, more open and welcoming to enlarge the circle rather than to keep it exclusively to just two people. A third contrast between friendship and agape is picked up in a wonderful image that C.S. Lewis uses in his wonderful little book, The Four Loves. He says, lovers are face-to-face, friends side-by-side. And what he means to capture by that is the image of the lovers who are absorbed in one another and whose eyes are fixed upon the gaze of the other, and who are in love, and when in love, completely captivated by one another's hopes and lives and aspirations, and are hence face to face. And friends often, if not always, then at least characteristically, side by side, facing common projects which they share and which accounts for, in some sense, their friendship, looking not so much in that sort of self-absorbed, dreamy way into one another's eyes, but sitting together at a ball game, or sitting together making a quilt, or sitting together at a session at Holden, or working together on a common task or enterprise. So again, one doesn't want to overdo that contrast. One can find certainly some of those enterprises characteristic of lovers as well, but I think you feel the difference in that friends often are brought together and deepened in their friendship by these common tasks outside of themselves. Lovers often caught up for protracted lengths of times in the dynamics of their own relationship one to the other. Another contrast. Romantic love, we learned, at least from the medieval reading that we did last week, oftentimes grows more intense when it faces certain obstacles it has to overcome. Obstacles of absence and distance, obstacles of difference in social class or parental disapproval. Obstacles often, as in the case of Romeo and Juliet and other classic lovers, tend to cause erotic love to deepen or at least intensify. Whereas friendship seems quite the opposite. It's not at all clear that absence makes friendships grow fonder. What tends to make friendships more deep and rich is the actual presence of the other friend, his or her face and voice and physical being, and protracted absences over long distances. A lack of shared experience often causes that friendship quickly to, if not quickly, then eventually to wane. So that may be another difference between romantic love and friendship. And then getting into some of the contrasts I have on the board between friendship and agape, this is a difference than the last one I'm going to list between actually friendship and eros. Friendship has to be in order to be friendship. Friendship must be mutual. Eros need not be at all. I mean, lyric poetry is filled with stories of unrequited love, a kind of longing again. Remember Eros, grounded in desire for an other who doesn't return that love. But we still talk about the person being in love even though the love isn't returned when we're speaking of erotic love. We would think it peculiar to talk about someone being someone else's friend when the other person is unaware of that longing, unaware of that choice, or not reciprocating it. We can even speak of people being in love when the other person's not even aware of the person loving them. This would be inconceivable when it comes to friendship. Friendship is inherently mutual and reciprocal. And this brings me to the, I just listed three characteristics of agape on the left, the Christian love, by contrast to characteristics of friendship on the right. Friendship tends to be, I'm reading down now the numerals, 1, 2, 3, preferential. That is, being grounded in choice, we choose some friends to the exclusion of others. We're not equally good friends with everyone. And so our circle of friends, I think most of our circle of friends, would tend to be rather small and selective. Agape is universal. We're called as Christians to love as God loves, the God who maketh his rain to fall upon the evil and the good, the just and the unjust, the God whose love for human beings is without respect to their merits or demerits. By contrast, we often choose our friends particularly with regard to their merits or demerits, I should say their merits of character, which is what draws us to them, something worthy of our love as friends. Secondly, I've already mentioned in the course of my conversation about Eros and the contrast between Eros and philia or friendship, this reciprocity or mutuality that is essential to friendship. And again, agape seeks not its own. We are not loving others agapeistically for the sake of their returning that love to us. Indeed, we're called even to love enemies who, by definition, wouldn't be expected to return that kind of love. So again, a fairly sharp and pointed contrast there between friendship and agape. And thirdly, friendship changes because friends change. Over time, the characters who grew up as high school chums and swore that they would never part, one goes off to college and the other doesn't. There's physical distance, soon there's educational distance. Soon the one has children, the other doesn't. There's a lack of, say, common experiences, and because people change, friendships, sadly, end. That's not, again, true of agape, which is steadfast and everlasting, and again, does not depend, or should not depend, upon these details of time and space and change. So that's to kind of get a little bit at the nature of friendship by virtue of contrasting it on the one hand with Eros and agape. And I want to say three more brief things about three different kinds of friendship, and then I want to test some of these observations against your experiences of friendship. So let me try to list under the general heading friendship what one of the most profound thinkers, I think, about friendship said about it, which is that once one agrees that all friendships have the characteristic of mutuality, which I mentioned, and involve a kind of mutual, warm well-wishing, I wish my friend well, he or she wishes me well, one can talk about three different kinds of friendship with respect to, number one, first kind, pleasure, number two, the second kind, utility or advantage, and number three, the third kind, character. And let me explain friendships of pleasure, friendships of advantage, and friendships of character, which are supposed to be the highest and the best and the most enduring. Friendships of pleasure are friendships that tend not to last very long and are based on simply one quality that we find amusing, that we find pleasing in another person, and are friends with them for just that reason. They're ready-witted. They have a sense of humor, and we're constantly entertained and become friendly with them. And we have some quality which they find equally entertaining. But it isn't as though that relationship is based upon some overall care for our well-being in general, but just a kind of pleasure in our ready-wittedness or some other skill or trait that we bring to the relationship. These tend to be oftentimes intense, but often short, because once we have no more need of the pleasure, once we've heard the joke for the 19th time, once we too have learned to trout fish, the person has taught us to do that, and that was the only thing making for the relationship, giving us pleasure, the friendship tends to end. But it's a friendship nonetheless. During the course of its life, a day, a month, possibly a year, we really have had mutual pleasure in that relationship, and it ends. The second one, and I think the more characteristic one, is friendship for the sake of utility or advantage. There's oftentimes a situation we're thrown together at Holden, let's say. We're thrown together and we're all mavericks, okay? Or we're thrown together at Valparaiso University painting dormitory rooms in our summer job. And we're thrown together with people that we didn't choose, but that were there, and we wind up performing a common task, and it's important that we each serve each other, it's important that we each paint well and pull our own weight in order for the job to get done. And in the course of that being mutually useful to one another through our work, we become chums and friends, but the summer ends and the friendship wasn't grounded in anything more deep, that is, a full appreciation for one another's character, but an appreciation for how useful we were to each other doing good work, and the friendship at the end of the summer ends. You remember when you were in high school how suddenly the first person to get a driver's license had lots of friends. The person may have been totally anonymous, but now as the first person to drive, suddenly people pour out in warm and benevolent friendship for that person. And then they get their driver's licenses, and, you know, it may be that one or two of them remain friends there because the friendship has deepened into type three, but more frequently, friendships based on utility or advantage are also rather short-lived. Third one, friendship based on character. There we really do enter in to the soul of the other, come to share his or her deepest aspirations, which become ours as well, because we care so much for their well-being. And therefore, that kind of friendship based on character is one in which we wish the other well for his or her own sake. Not for what he or she can do for us, as in drive us around town with the first license. Not because of what he or she can do to please us, as in entertain us with their ready-wittedness. But because of what he or she most truly and deeply is, what matters most deeply to them. And it's that to which we give our benediction, our well-wishing, and that becomes mutual and we become friends, sharing a common adventure of human life together. So those are the three kinds of friendship, and they obviously shade into one another. They're not mutually exclusive. You could have a friendship of character that began out of a friendship of pleasure or a friendship of utility. But I do think it's helpful to see that our use of the word friendship, like Aristotle's, has a rather broad extension. We use words like chums or best friends as opposed to friends to try to get at this. But I think it captures something of the variety of relationships that we use the word friend to describe, even though when pressed, we definitely want to reserve a special word, say best friends, for those three people I invited you to consider, which I think probably we'll discover, or maybe we won't, are illustrations of friendships of character. One final point, and then we'll open this up for discussion. And this is a very interesting, I think, problem. One of the things which some writers on friendship have thought is that friendships of the highest and best sort, I'm just going to talk now about type three, the ones, friendships of character, friendships of the highest and best sort must have about them a condition of complete equality. Equality. That means that it's thought by some writers that you're not likely to get friendships of the highest and best sort where there are extreme differences of things like age, experience, power. In other words, you're not apt to be best friends with someone who also has power over you, who is your employer, who is the one who is handing out grades in a class that you're taking, etc. It's thought that in order to have, at least by some thinkers, friendship of the highest and best sort, there has to be a condition of equality, where one person isn't beholden, no pun intended, to the other person for the source of his or her livelihood, but that both feel that they're bringing to the friendship equal amounts of worthy and praiseworthy traits or skills or qualities, and there's not an imbalance in power. It's interesting to figure out then in this context if this is right, and it's a question I'm going to throw out to you once we first test whether or not the general description fits, whether or not, say for example, the relationship between a mother and a daughter, or a father and a daughter, or a mother and a son, can count as a friendship of the highest and best sort, because there would seem to be obviously for at least a long part of their lives together this kind of imbalance, this kind of inequality. And I think one thing we'll want to test when we talk about the three people you thought of is whether or not you listed on your list someone with whom there is substantial inequality with respect to experience, with respect to virtue, with respect to age, with respect to wealth, with respect to any number of other things. Okay? So those are just some general observations now, trying to get at the nature of friendship, recognizing that that's difficult. And I think the floor is open now for general questioning or refinement of what I've said, or some testimony about the extent to which what I've generally said fits one or another of the people on your list.
I have a 25-year friendship that I think is going to slowly dissipate. I see the ending coming. We were put together when we first began teaching in the same school system. She was a music teacher, I was a music teacher. We shared the same room. She had just lost her husband, and there was a contact. We magnetically were drawn together and became close friends. We've been close friends for years and years. After I moved out of the system, we write to each other. But when I was teaching in Germany, she came to Germany to touch base, to fill that gap. Then, by the way, this takes place in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And as I have come back to the States, now I go to Valpo several times a year, and I go to Kalamazoo, and I visit her in her classroom. And I teach for a day, and she gives me her class, and this has kept us in the classroom situation. And I've done this for about 5 or 6 years. The ending of this friendship is coming because she's retiring. She's no longer going to be in the classroom. I cannot keep in touch, you know, physically with her anymore. And she may or may not come out to Washington someday, but I don't really know. And she has many, many grandchildren. She has a big family that surrounds her. And so she will pretty much stay put where she's at. And I see this ending. Mm-hmm. I see this ending. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to miss her terribly. Mm-hmm. But I know that's going to happen. It's inevitable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Your story raises two interesting questions, I think. The narrative that you shared with us indicates that you're fearful that your friendship may end because of now not regular physical presence with one another, number one, and number two, a beginning of a waning of a shared interest that really bound you together as you stood side by side facing this common love that you had for music. Do you think it's possible in our day and age of email to sustain deep friendships of the highest and best sort with telephones and email, or do you think that there's something about friendships of the highest and best sort now that require at least periodic, say annual, times when you are together face to face? I'm just curious what you think about
that. I don't think it has to be annual. I have a friend that I met over 28 years ago when we were freshmen in high school, I think. Mm-hmm. Somewhere around there. And we see each other very seldom. We haven't lived, I mean, she's been in California. I've been in Iowa for the last 13 years. Before that, she was in Kansas. I was in California. Our constant communication has been the written word. And now she has a 3-year-old son and his godmother, but I didn't see him until he was 3. Mm. But the communication and the time when we're together is as good as ever.
Great. So there's an example that what's been about once every 3 years over the past 13?
Very erratic over the last 13 years because of my being in Iowa, her changing marriages, and any number of things.
Other comments on this point. How important is physical presence to sustain friendships of the highest and best sort?
I don't think it's all important. I have my college roommate over 50 years. I've hardly seen her, but we correspond really often. And, you know, we have many things in common, and I think our friendship is still as solid as a rock.
Now, is she on your list of three that I asked you? She was on your list. Was your friend on your list? Okay, so we have an example of two people whose lists of three best friends included folks that they have seen very, very
seldom
over a long period of time.
But it sounds like they're committed to corresponding at least through writing.
I would have to say that for me, building a relation of friendship at the highest level takes a lot of trust and honesty, and for me that is more easily attained through a physical seeing you, watching you listen to me develops my trust and my honesty and then heightens the friendship. So physicalness is important to me.
Was it important for those two women who spoke in building the friendship?
Yeah, we had years together.
Yes.
Before we were friends. And we lived together for 2 years in college. And then after that, we've been separated since 74. But it's still strong.
So it may be important in building the friendship, but not necessarily in sustaining it. Yes, in fact.
I had the same experience over 40 years. Friend back in St. Louis with high school and college with. And then I came out to the Northwest and been out here for 36 years. And periodic communication, sometimes we get together. But, you know, godfathers, and best men, and all that stuff over those years.
Good.
Not even many phone calls.
Good. Thank you. Deanne, you were going to say something?
I think it's not just about the physical presence, but it's also an issue of and maybe this goes back to the different types, the sorts of things that one shares. And daily or at least frequent contact allows one to share a kind of ordinary detail of life. You know, washing dishes together after a dinner party, that sort of thing. But often that kind of sharing of everyday life together also allows a more abstract, more profound kind of commonality, which doesn't necessarily require washing dishes together. It's just nurtured by them. And the question you raised is one that I think of a lot. And my three people, only one lives in the same town I do. How much of my life isn't local? And it's partly because of electronic mail and transportation that I can hope annually to see those people. But it does have an effect then on your daily life if your most profound relationships aren't local.
Very nice point. Yes.
I would like to add a dimension to this of personalities. And let me speak, if you will, if you'll bear with me, on the left and the right side of the brain, personalities. Your left brain personalities are people who are verbal, the written word, cognitive, this type of thing. The right side of the brain is more feeling, impressionable, nonverbal. And so for those friendships of people who enjoy words, the written word really will help a friendship sustain itself. Those of us who are not so verbal and share experiences with another person that you can't put into words and you need the person there to experience with, that's another ballpark. And so I think what we're hearing here are the different personalities speaking out depending on, and you reach out to friends who you can communicate with. And if I'm right-brained, and I am, I teach friends that are right-brained. Mm-hmm. Because I can't relate very well to left-brained people. Mm-hmm. We don't share the same experiences. We don't see the world the same way.
One more comment on this point, and then we'll move on to another question.
I just wonder if we will see, since times are changing rapidly in communication, a renaissance of this ancient Greek friendship, that the chat rooms we see now in marriages that maybe all of us in this room have even heard or experienced that have started in that, and we will soon have capability of having complete video two-way in our own homes all around the world instantaneously. You wonder if that will change a lot of this cocooning that we see where we're all just kind of holding up and playing video games, and wondering if the thing will turn the other way, we'll end up with more friendships.
That's a very good question. Clearly, some of what we've heard here suggests that we may very well see something like that, since some people, at least, who started friendships in a locale, face-to-face, sharing a common life as roommates, have continued to sustain those over long distances. They have raised a question, though, as to whether or not friendships could begin and friendships could start and have the same quality that the folks who started their friendships face-to-face could have, whether one could start internet friendships and sustain those and have them have the depth that a friendship where you did start it in physical presence would have. That's a very interesting question. Yes?
Bob, I've been thinking about the difference of age. It seems to me I have quite a number of friends who are both younger and older than I am. Excuse me. And it seems to me that when you talk about mutuality or equality, that perhaps the basis of your friendship may be centered around a particular thing as a starting point, and at that point you're equal, but not in every other thing. I mean, for instance, you might share a love of music, but that leads into some very deep sharing, but you're perhaps not in other ways equal. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure that it's not a common experience to have people that are different in a lot of other ways besides the one that is the organizing principle of your association or your friendship.
So you might want to modify the equality by saying equal with respect to something central to the friendship, but not necessarily with respect to everything.
Yeah.
Michael?
Just an interesting question. I mean, in teaching Aristotle on friendship, too, I ask students, and it'd be interesting. I don't know, it's kind of an incriminating question, and that is, when you think about your three best friends, particularly for married people, is your spouse considered one of those best friends? And interestingly enough, at least when you ask that question to students, many of them understand very easily within a marriage, certainly notions of pleasure, primarily they would understand that in terms of utility or advantage. But there's a real interesting debate and conversation that goes on in terms of whether or not spouse qualifies in that notion of character and best friend. So I've always found that interesting.
It is an interesting question. I mean, Aristotle clearly, in that culture, would have found that highly implausible,
right,
that you would be best friends with your spouse. But we have, in our own history, been treated to a vast period in which the companionship marriage was held up as a kind of ideal, and that the notion was that the best marriages were in fact grounded in friendship, and that has to do with massive social changes about the relative position of men and women in the culture and so forth and so on. But that is I'm not going to call on people and ask them to volunteer answers to that question here, but I do think you feel the importance of it, to how many included spouse on their list of three, and what does that say, and so forth. I want to follow up on this question about distance with a second question, which has bedeviled writers on friendship, and ask you to appeal to your list now. One group of writers on friendship of the highest and best sort now. From now on, when I talk about friendship, I'm going to restrict it to friendship of the highest and best sort, people you would call best friends, friendships of character. Question is, birds of a feather flock together here. I mean, in other words, is it finally a kind of deep likeness, a kind of familiarity with a part of your own soul that accounts for your best friend being your best friend? Even if there are surface differences, all the more exciting if on the surface you tick off the skin color, the language, etc., and still discover that in spite of all of these surface differences, accidents of birth and social class and whatnot, underneath you share these common aspirations and these common longings and these common gifts and pleasures and all the rest. So there's one school who thinks that that's finally what makes the best friendships. Another school thinks, no, on the contrary, right brain and left brain people, or however you want to carve up the world here, actually attract, opposites attract, and the best friendships are made up of people who are all the way down quite different, not just surface different, but depth difference. Where do you people come out on that if you look at your list, in terms of what you think makes for the best friendships? Yes.
May I add a third? Mm-hmm. Some people think that you are attracted to a person very similar to your parent of the opposite sex. The man tends to marry his mother and so on.
Attracted to, say that again?
Some people think that a person is attracted in choosing a spouse to a person who is very similar in character to their parent of the opposite sex, meaning a man would tend to marry his mother, a woman would tend to marry a man like her father, that there's more commonality in that spouse and the parent.
I see. Okay, good, yes.
In looking at my list of three, the thing that strikes me is it's an approach to life, same set of values, place very high value on family, pride in work, a lot of interest in life in general, as opposed to the type of work we do, our extrovert-introvert relationships and stuff like that. It's the value structure that we have that locks us together.
It's the value structures. Even though your personalities may be different,
yes,
other things,
right.
It's finally sharing a common set of values. I see lots of people nodding vigorously to that, as though that's the formulation they were using. Other comments on this?
I'll go back to what Carol said about sharing, for example, a love of music. I think that there has to be some point of commonality, but partly what determines that is this sort of values or view of life, or, you know, it won't be the same configuration or cluster of things that would necessarily draw different sets of friends together. There's a lovely phrase in Rita Scudder's autobiography where she talks about a long-term friend of hers, and she describes her by saying, "We shared laughter and prayers." And it gave you a sense of what was most important to those two people and important to them together. But I could imagine people for whom variety and difference and conflict were the highest values. And so it would be a common desire for difference that would draw very different people together.
For me, it would include all of these differences, but somehow, for me, the friendships I think about have a lot of mileage on them, and it's not just from the number of years, and it has a depth of intimacy to it that, you know, I've had to make decisions to invest in it and be safe in it and to receive from it, not just for selfish advantage, but if you're utilitarian. But that there were outcomes that I never dreamed of. There were things that caused me to grow that I never could have done in another way, you know, because of that. But I think this decision thing, that you decide to reinvest and you continue to do that, and that's work. I mean, it's not just accidental or because you both like to dance or something. You know, it really is something about the soul, about the sense of self being connected and making a decision to do that. And sometimes I've made that decision and it hasn't worked, and it's been disappointing or it's been, you know, hurtful. Well, you know, that's information.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think this is to add another dimension to the conversation thus far, that is that what enriches a friendship is also the fact that each has a sense of having invested a great deal of him or herself in it, having made decisions on the basis of sustaining that friendship, having put that as a priority over lots of other things as to how to invest one's time and so forth, because we all are finite, and there are times when we can choose to make more friends or deepen the present ones we have, spend more time or less time at work, family, all the other things and so forth, and that over the course of years together, one of the things that's working to deepen the friendship is precisely that mutual sense of each having invested such a large stretch of his or her life, not just sharing a common history, not just sharing common projects, but sharing this common investment of the self in making the friendship what it has become as a kind of life's project,
kind of
commitment that creates a new reality that doesn't come about simply as the result, but that creates a new reality due to that kind of commitment. Thank you. Other comments on this question? I want to get to the equality question, which Carol's already touched upon a bit. I asked you to think about, on your list of three, whether or not there were any instances where someone on that list is just obviously superior or inferior to you with respect to age, experience, education, et cetera, so that there's a substantial inequality, especially with regard to power, or whether or not they all have the characteristic of a kind of equality, accepting Carol's amendment to say that that could include a kind of equality with respect to what's central to the friendship itself, that feature that makes the friendship friendship. Anybody have any substantial inequalities in this? Nobody.
Well, a friendship can start with an inequality, but it can change, right?
And can you give an example?
As the friendship grows, it can become equality. That's what I've seen happen in my life.
Okay. Other people have that experience? So friendships have started out where there's a substantial mismatch.
The friends that I had in my mind, one of them is like 10 years older than me. The other one is maybe 15 years younger than me and a working partner. There's some that floated on the edge that one of them has been a friend of mine since I went to college with her, and she's in my wedding, and I just see her every once in a while. But we keep in touch at Christmas time, and we call once in a while. But it's, when we come together, it's like we have never been apart. We have, you know. One of the friends that I have, I find it hard to understand why I still stay a friend, because I don't always want to be a friend, but there's something about the friendship that I keep the friendship. And I have to put effort in to returning a call or to continuing it, and it's a confusing kind of friendship. And I don't understand why that, what need that is filling in me, you know, what that, I mean, she doesn't seem to fall in the categories that you've talked about.
So some friendships just have an irreducible element of mystery to them, basically.
No, I don't know. It's kind of a confusing thing, you know? Mm-hmm. But those are basically my, you know, inequalities that I would relate into mine. Age would be the issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've been surprised to have students as friends. It seems like the power difference and the age difference and all kinds of differences really ought to prevent that. But in some cases, they just haven't. Those differences, while either of us would acknowledge them, haven't seemed to matter. And with others, other students that I was very close to, it was a student relationship. And when they weren't students anymore, their relationship went away. So it's not close and not so close. It's, do those big differences that you refer to really matter? Are they part of that core mm-hmm. that we're talking about? And in some cases, they're not there.
Now, did those friendships that with students, did they tend to grow even more deep once they ceased to be your student in some kind of strictly formal sense? That they were in your class, you were giving them grades, et cetera?
No, I think the characteristic of these students is that there really hasn't been any transition here at all. The way they were friends as my students is the same way, same intensity, same trajectory, same intensity, same all kind of stuff as before. It really didn't ever matter,
mm-hmm.
which puzzled us both, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's one counterexample to the claim, yes.
I've had a dear friend for many years. There's almost a 20-year age difference. At one point, she became my boss and was my boss for many, many years, and we had sort of a compartmentalized friendship that was a work relationship and then a friendship apart from that, away from work. She's now retired, and though we don't see each other face-to-face quite as often, I'm probably on the phone with her three or four times a week. And were very, very close friends. If you had said four people, she probably would have been the fourth one on the list.
Uh-huh. Good. So there's another example where there's a clear power difference and age difference both. I think age is less important numerically than we're talking about maturity levels here. So, for example, the difference would be very unlikely for a 20-year-old and a 10-year-old to be, but when a 40 and 50, those 10 are a lot different than the difference between 10 and 20. I think the point is maturity and experience. But I think that your example is interesting, as is his, in that here there was a clear, you were the employee and she was the employer. Is that how it worked? Okay. And yet you remained friends throughout all of that just by being very conscious, I gather, from what you said, about the difficulties you could get into if you mix those things improperly, right? So with some vigilance, that can be done. Yes.
Well, I'm also a teacher, but I taught junior high at the time, and I have one friend who was on my list of three, who has since graduated from college, and we've become very, very good friends. He kept in contact with me during high school and college, and he went to my alma mater, Augustana, too. And that probably helped cement it a little bit. But it wasn't until we were equal and he was he had graduated that we actually became really deep friends and really shared more. Before it was probably more, I was more of a guidance person to him maybe. But now I would say that it's definitely equal and we will probably remain friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rest of my life.
Good. Parents and children pose a special case of this, right?
Yeah.
That is to say, you clearly have, for a good share of the early years, a total imbalance of power, maturity, etc., and dependence. One is dependent on the other. And yet the child continues to grow, though you didn't choose this child and this child didn't choose you. So there's that missing from the typical friendship pattern. They didn't choose you as the parent, you didn't choose them as the child, but nonetheless you shared a life. Do any of you have the experience of having a certain moment wherein the equalization takes place and you do find yourself really best friends with one of your own children or one of your parents? Is that a wonderful gift overtaken some of you? Yes? Other people, yes, this has happened? Or does this seem, no?
I think I'm more of a, have a, I don't know better, but more of a like-minded friendship with my mother-in-law than my mother.
Well, let me see if I can draw some of these observations together and then wind things up and ready ourselves for Vespers. Much of what you've said by way of your own stories, in particular the earlier ones about how certain friendships that began in the actual sharing of a common life, roommates, etc. Which Aristotle thought, by the way, and a lot of the ancients thought was essential to friendship, that you share a life. Not necessarily that you live together, but that you live in close proximity and have common projects and quotidian, everyday experiences together. But many of you have testified that really, though that may have been true of the inception of a friendship, you've sustained rich and ever-deepening friendships over great distances of space and only through correspondence of one kind or another. And then some of you have talked about exceptions to some of the other general rules about equality and power and so forth, which does suggest that these categories or classifications and distinctions fail to capture the richness in the varieties of human friendship, even though there are some commonalities. But they also point to something else, I think, that the ancients thought, and that I think our culture has lost sight of, at least on the front burner, and that I think your conversations about friendship bring to mind. The ancients thought that really what was the feature of humankind that made humans human was the rational part of their souls. In other words, what makes you you, according to the ancients, had to do with, in effect, the rational, not the appetitive, not your longings so much as your thoughts and speeches. What you said, what you thought, made Bill Bill and Frank Frank and Sue Sue and all of the individuality, but all the commonality you shared with other human beings. So that if you were going to be intimate, most deeply intimate with another person, you did so not by sharing as the animals, other animals would, bodily fluids, and which many people think today is the mark of the deepest intimacy, but by sharing, in effect, thoughts and speeches, which you could share in your correspondence, on your email, over the phone, etc., etc., because what really makes you you are these things about you, and therefore the highest and the best friendships would be sustained and deepened by that kind of intercourse, if you will. The sharing of thoughts and speeches, which was the deepest form of human intimacy. I think our culture has drifted away from that, at least explicitly if you look at our films and so on, but implicitly maybe from our experiences as we reflect on them and look at what have made our best friends and what have sustained those friendships over time and what have made them such wonderful gifts. It may be that we're not that far distant, at least in terms of our own experiences, from that bit of wisdom and insight about friendship, which is a kind of love grounded in, as we said, choice and character, and which is still arguably, by comparison to Eros, the more steadfast, the more rich, and the more treasured form of love. It certainly was for the ancients. Whether it is today, we'll continue to discuss tomorrow and on Friday. So thanks for your attention, and hope to see some of you at the double feature tonight. Same film, 8:30 and 10:30.